Greetings and welcome to MERS Monday, the official podcast of the MERS Political Newsletter. I'm Kyle Malin, joined by the whole gang here, Craig Mauger, John Roering, Jacob Kanzler, and Lauren Gibbons. This is our pre-St. Patrick's Day podcast, as you heard from our intro music there, Scurryvore, who I happened to hear at Irish Fest a few years ago. Seemed to be the consensus favorite here among the folks here. Even Craig liked it. And you know what, Lauren? I think our goal, this podcast, should infuse Craig with the Irish spirit, since I think he's the only one in this room who is still hasn't really quite grasped the whole Irish spirit.
I agree. I think, Craig, I think it's important that you have some Irish spirit.
Did you say Scurryvore?
Scurryvore.
Oh, okay.
Scurryvore. Like, yeah.
They have some interesting names, those Irish bands. They often are pretty
interesting.
Fantastic.
So we're going to kick this off here with a little Irish greeting that should get us into the spirit, and then we've got some additional things for you a little later here, Craig.
Hello, fellow Klansmen from the House and the Senate down in our great capital city of Lansing, Michigan. This is the old state rep and state senator, Johnny Gleason, with a word of advice. Just remember, my friends, campaigning is like courtship. It is the time when someone can determine whether they can do better or not. So fairly well, and I always keep you in mind, you're in my prayers and in my thoughts. And when you hoist your pint on the 17th, always keep the other lad and lass in mind, and so always strive for world peace. I tell you, may the road rise to meet you, but these Michigan roads are in too disrepair. God bless each and every one of you. Thanks for the great time we shared over 10 long years in our capital venture together. God bless each and every one.
That was amazing.
That was pretty awesome, wasn't it?
That's perfect. Let's have those pothole-filled roads rise to meet us.
I love that guy. Great St. Patrick's Day podcast tradition here.
I think that's probably arguably one of the best variations of an Irish blessing, if you will.
Yeah, we may see that a little later on the quote of the day, maybe. It depends what Craig gets during his pundit piece. But let's talk about this issue here that he brings up about the roads, because as a Democrat, he's probably getting some people coming up to him saying, what should we do on this proposal? One, the Democratic Party has not come out with anything. Lon Johnson has not come out with anything yet. And Democrats seem to be mixed on this thing, Craig. We've got Mark Schauer taking one position. Dan Kildee took a different position last time he was in town. Debbie Dingell, you know, wasn't necessarily for it, wasn't necessarily opposed to it. If you're a Democrat, why would you oppose this ballot proposal?
You would oppose it because all along Democrats have said that increasing the sales tax to fund road improvements is a regressive and bad idea. I mean, that was their statement from the very beginning when this was first being talked about a couple of years ago. The sales tax is regressive. It's not the best way, according to them, to raise money to improve our roads.
Now, John, you've taken a look at this.
Except it's not regressive in this case. And the Democrats and the legislature helped to make sure that wasn't the case. By adding the increasing the earned income tax credit back to 20%, you're going to lift, according to the League for Human Services, 15,000 families out of poverty with that tax credit. And actually, if you look at the lowest income families, they will get as much as a $600 kick-up in terms of more revenue coming in from that credit than they will pay. So it's actually a net increase of $600 a year for those families. So it's, you can't argue it's regressive. If you look at the numbers, it doesn't go there.
If you're a Democrat, you could argue
you could
argue that there are less regressive ways to do this, though.
But let's talk about
this is not a regressive tax.
Well, what about if you don't qualify for the EITC here? I mean, what if you're just the working class or the middle class and you wouldn't qualify for that anyway? You could argue this is a regressive tax in the sense that businesses aren't paying what they should be paying for our roads. You know, was that ever considered? Was that ever put on the table as an answer? Now, there's going to be some truck weights that are going to be added to this thing, but how much will businesses be kicking to that? Is that a viable argument, Jacob?
People are going to go back to that. I mean, because Dems have been able to, since 2010, 2011, hit on the business tax restructuring. So every time that, you know, we take a hit in the budget, we take a hit in the taxes, they're going to be like, why aren't businesses paying their fair share?
Lauren, so what's the counter to that? Why should Democrats support this ballot proposal?
They made a lot of strides during the initial talks during lame duck. They arguably, on their perspective, got a lot of stuff out of that they probably wouldn't be able to get moving forward if this fails, if we go to another alternative. A lot of the strides that they made would not be something that they could replicate should this fail and should we have to go back to the drawing board here.
So when is the next time the Democrats could get full restoration of the EITC? When could we guarantee that universities won't get funded out of school aid fund, for example?
Right, yeah, and it's really not clear at this point. So that's the argument in support for it. You know, it's just...
Possibly
it's
2022 after the new redistricting maps take place, if they can get control of A-Chamber before then, which is a big if.
Because we're not 2018, maybe they can get the governor's office, maybe they could get the House, but the Senate, boy, that's going to be a heavy lift.
I don't think you'd see the EITC coming from this legislature. I don't think it would happen.
So then what are some other reasons why Democrats would support this ballot proposal?
Our roads are awful.
Well, we've got that going, right? I mean, there's always that argument, but could you also argue the union trades and the jobs that could be provided, Craig?
Obviously, unions that work in the road industry would like to see this pass because it would create some more jobs, but I think for a lot of Democrats, the thing that they have to be staring at and considering at night when they're thinking about this is, what is the alternative that's going to be pushed if this fails?
Well, and the alternative could be so damaging that the Republicans would actually walk down that road and make themselves politically susceptible. Let's say they say, okay, well, we're going to try and raise this by ourselves. We're going to do the Bulger plan, for instance, and we're going to cut the heck out of, I don't know, education, out of higher ed, out of human services, to get to that money to put toward the roads. Could that put them, Democrats in general, in a better position going into the 2016 and possibly 2018 election?
I mean, that's a good point because, I mean, as long as the Republicans are in control as much as they are, the burden to do some kind of road funding plan is going to fall on them. Right. So you could take that tack. You could say, you know, the D's say we're going to oppose the Prop 1, and it's going to kick back the solution back to the legislature. They're going to eventually maybe force these Republican legislators to take that tough vote that a lot of people say they avoided in December.
That may be good politics, but it's terrible public policy. Look, the Democrats have argued for this EITC for a long time. Road construction benefits a lot of Democrats, a lot of union folks. It puts people back to work. And then you're gonna roll this on a gambit that in 2 years you might have an upper hand in putting the Republicans down. That's just, you know.
And let's go back, I mean, to this election that we just had. Didn't we just see this play out? The Republicans didn't fix your roads, was, you know, the Democrats kept saying. They're kicking the can down the road on this. And Mark Schauer didn't really have an alternative plan to fix the roads that people viewed as credible. So that's what it's going to come down to. I mean, if the Democrats play this game of chicken that we're just going to, you know, wait and let the Republicans take the fall for, you know, not fixing the roads, at some point they're going to have to come up with an alternative because that's what people want to see. What is your plan to fix the roads?
Well, look, Republicans can come back. The Democrats turn their back on the earned income tax credit to help all these families. What kind of party is that?
Well, you could also argue, though, that there are other alternatives out there that were never really seriously considered by this governor and this legislature. For example, maybe additional bonding. We have room under our debt cap. According to at least one economist, our debt load is very manageable. How about expanding the CIT, the corporate income tax? We could expand that to a larger pool of people. Was that ever really considered? I think Gretchen Whitmer had an idea out there as well in regards to making businesses pay more. Maybe instead of 6% for the corporate income tax, raising that an extra point. That could have been another thing that was put on the table. But again, you know, while those are all good ideas, I guess you can come back with, is that ever viable? Would that ever happen anyway? And John, you're kind of shaking your head like...
You can take the corporate income tax off the table. I don't think that would have passed out of the legislature. You know, the problem with this proposal is, I know there's lots of little pieces and fractures you can pick at if you're not inclined to support it, but I don't see anything better coming along, and I don't know how you get back to where we are at as far as a funding solution without this combination that kind of came out of a lame duck.
Then you got to kind of ask yourself, how many Democrats then, with all this in mind, okay, so I think maybe the synopsis we get out of this is a smelly pile of poo, but is there anything else better out there? So maybe they just stay away from it altogether and they don't vote, period. So maybe we won't see a lot of Democrats come out to the polls unless there's something else out there to get them excited at the local level. Maybe that's possible. I guess I'm just throwing that out there. Are they going to be driven to want to vote anyway, I guess is my point.
Well, I don't know if this proposal one is a partisan issue, right now.
Right.
I think it's going to be a family by family, person by person decision. I view this as a tax increase. So I'm going to vote against this. Or the road in front of my house is terrible. I'm going to vote for this because I view this as a way to fix it. Unless Democratic Party leadership says, we want to come out and take a stand on this and really try to make this a partisan issue, that's the only way I could see that really becoming a major factor in this.
Joining us now, Ray Holman of the UAW 6000. You're the director now, aren't you?
No, I'm the UAW Local 6000 Legislative Liaison.
All right. Well, thanks for joining us on the podcast, Ray. This DCH-DHS merger, do you get the sense that Governor Snyder and these two departments had this thing pretty well thought out when they went ahead and announced this decision?
No. I think there's a lot of unanswered questions and a lot of potential consequences. When the merger was announced back during the State of the State address, it was something that, in theory, I suppose we could support, because for a long time, the UAW Local 6000 has been saying we need to be more efficient, we need to make the tax dollar go longer like everybody else. So in theory, it's something we could support, but the devil will be in the details. And we're just concerned how the merger is going to play out over the next few months.
Now, we've got 60 days since it's been signed for the legislature to take action. But have you really heard anything since the EO was signed that leads you to believe that there's a lot of details? Or you said the devil's in the details, but have we seen any details that would make you be able to sniff out a devil?
No, I haven't seen any details. I can say that we've had communications with the director, Nick Lyon, and he's been very easy to talk to, and he's indicated that he's willing to work with us and listen to frontline staff, which we think is a good idea and would be a positive change. But in terms of the details, we really don't know. Obviously, there's huge concerns with the Department of Human Services right now. We're understaffed in the field. We don't have enough caseworkers working in the various branch offices. We have software issues with that department. So there's a lot of concerns already, never mind the merger. So we're just going to have to wait and see what happens. But no, we don't have any details. We don't know exactly how this is going to work out. Nick Lyon, the director, again, has been very open with us. He's indicated this is not about cutting staff. This is about finding efficiencies. This is about putting people first, program second. And again, in theory, that's something we've been calling for a long time.
Yeah, there was a joint hearing of a few legislative subcommittees on this merger a while back, and Nick Lyon kept repeating to lawmakers who were asking questions for more details, we're going to tell employees first, and then we're going to get you the information that you want. Has he come forward with any of this information to the employees so far, or has it been pretty quiet?
You know, it's been really quiet right now. Again, we've had, you know, good conversations with Director Lyon. I think that he sincerely does want to hear from the frontline staff and work with the caseworkers, for example, in DHS. But again, no details. We don't know how this is going to unfold. We've had just recently some informational pickets because the caseworkers are swamped right now. As I mentioned earlier, we have software programs that don't work in the children's services side and in the payment side. So we're really kind of in a crisis mode right now already. Again, never mind the merger. So we'd like to hear what these details are, and we'd like to be involved in that process.
As it stands now, are you advising lawmakers to nix this order or not?
You know, again, regarding the merger itself, it's nothing that, in theory, we think it could be positive because, you know, there is a lot of overlap between the departments. When you talk about Medicaid, there's a lot of overlap. There are ways to make the system more efficient. You know, I think it is a positive thing when the governor mentioned People First Program second. And again, it's just going to be the matter of how that we get to that goal. It's going to be difficult because these are very complex departments that do complicated things. But I really don't have any answers in terms of what the details are or how this is going to work.
Oh, Ray, you mentioned the DHS staffing. Can you bring us up to date here and kind of where we're at with layoffs? I think we had about 100 in February. I think Director Lyon hinted at some later on this fiscal year and possibly next. What's your understanding of kind of the total hit to staffing in DHS in the near future?
Well, this is a real sore spot for us because what had happened was the Friday before Governor Snyder gave his State of the State address on a Tuesday, so a few days before, we learned that we're going to lose 100 positions. And we had known earlier in the summer that 352 positions wouldn't be funded. But so again, right before the State of the State, we learned that 100 people are actually going to lose their jobs. And so then the merger was announced. So, of course, we were concerned at that time. And that's during a time when, again, we're in crisis mode and we don't have enough staff already. So what we need to do is work together to invest in the people that have direct contact with the public. You know, we need to be smart with our state resources. But I can tell you right now, there's a huge problem in the field offices all around the state, not just in Detroit, but all the way up in the UP, everywhere. The caseworkers are swamped. And the problem is, if you don't address people's needs when they're in crisis at the front end, it's just going to turn into a bigger problem later.
How confident are you that this DCH-DHS merger will not involve caseworker layoffs? I mean, how else do you find efficiencies?
You know, one thing that the Coalition of State Employee Unions, which the UAW Local 6000 is a part of, we've been saying for years now that we need to have more frontline staff, less managers, less middle management. So obviously, if there's a way to streamline state government where you're, again, investing your resources with the people in the front lines, we support that. Of course, we're concerned that we would lose staff. You know, you'd mentioned, or I had mentioned, I guess, the 100 caseworkers that were laid off right before the State of State. You have to realize that also creates a ripple effect in bumping, and that creates a huge distraction for the people that already have a difficult job. So many people are changing work locations. Some people are physically moving. So when you talk about laying people off, you're also talking about a bumping process, and that, again, is a distraction.
Ray, how come historically DHS has gotten a rap as being a state department that is a little bit of a mess as far as the whole organization goes? Why is that?
Well, you often hear at the Capitol that DHS is sort of the problem child of the state departments. And I think part of it is what their mission is. You're talking about serving, you know, people in crisis. You're talking about complicated family issues. So I think that is part of it. I think that it's actually what we have to do as caseworkers, as state employees within that agency that presents challenges in and of itself. I think also you're talking about a department that deals a lot with the federal government, has federal strings attached to what it does. So that also causes complications.
Yeah, but DCH seems to have it together.
You know, it would appear that way, but again, you know, I should remind you and your listeners, Kyle, that, you know, DHS is the department that goes out into people's homes and has to investigate very serious situations, child abuse, child neglect, adult protective services. You're dealing with people in crisis all the time, every day. And so I just think it's very complicated, difficult work. And I think part of it is, again, just what the department's mission is, what it's created to do, it's hard.
You know, one other thing I want to touch on here, when DCH and DHS merges, how is that going to work with the unions? Because you all represent DHS employees at UAW 6000, but DCH has a completely different bargaining unit, right?
Yeah, that's right. So we have members in all the state departments. Our biggest department is DHS, but we do have quite a few in DCH. And one thing, too, about DCH, I should mention, there's 5 state hospitals, and we represent the nurses, psychologists, psychiatrists that works there, too. But, you know, in terms of the UAW Local 6000, we have labor management teams that work with each department. So how this is going to unfold is going to be interesting for us, too. I probably going to mean rearranging positions at our local as well. And a lot of those positions are elected. I think there's certain protocols how this is going to unfold. But again, there's lots of little ripples that are created when you merge two big giant departments on many ends, many levels.
So are you guys going to have to merge things at UAW?
Yeah, we probably will. So obviously there will be one big giant state department, so that'll probably mean, for example, merging the DCH labor management team with our DHS labor management team, and who becomes the chair of that? And those are questions I guess we'll have to work out internally. But again, we sort of mimic everything the state does, and so obviously we're going to have to respond to the change.
All right. Very good. Ray Holman from the UAW 6000. Thanks for joining us this week.
It was awesome to be here.
All right. So, Craig, if you haven't gotten into the Irish spirit yet, we've got a couple other things for you.
First,
we've got a present for you to open. Yeah, this is for you. This is to help get you in the Irish spirit.
I'm so excited.
Is it Irish whiskey?
Well, no. Mitch would have been good for that. But, yeah, I didn't do the Irish whiskey. I didn't have wrapping paper. All my wrapping paper at home was Christmas.
I hope you didn't like put Christmas meat in there. Like, no corned beef. I hope that's not.
Is it a portrait of John Gleason?
Well, he's sending that later. We should get that on St. Patrick's Day. He's already.
Oh, come on. My. Wow.
Oh, my God, it actually is meat.
Premium corned beef brisket. Wow, this is large.
Now, Kyle's known for just bringing in corned beef and just putting it on the counter here on St. Patrick's. That's when you know it's St. Patrick's Day.
You even took the price tag off, like a real gift.
I didn't want you to know how much I spent on it.
Okay, I do have a question, though. Does that need to be refrigerated?
Oh, yeah, it was in the fridge all weekend.
Okay.
Yeah, so it's only been out for about 30 minutes.
Okay. That's
gluten-free. Awesome.
Gluten-free. Now, I would recommend you roast it. That tastes better than the boil method.
Okay.
Yeah, so put it on your roasting pan, cover it with tin foil for 3 hours, and it's absolutely scrumptious.
Potatoes and carrots in it. That's what my mom always does.
Yeah.
Maybe we can get this going at MERS later today.
If we had an oven.
That's the only part of our kitchen we're missing.
Yeah.
We got to bring in the crock pot.
I have a crock pot, if that's something. I have some red potatoes, too. We could definitely have a MERS food party. I was thinking about bringing in soda bread tomorrow.
Oh, you were?
I was thinking about it, yeah. All right. I have a pretty good recipe.
Well, excellent. Well, and we got.
I'm excited. I'm in the spirit now. I'm in the spirit.
All right. Okay. Well, this is very exciting. Now, Lauren wants to share a little bit of Irish spirit here with us. Lauren is a, if not a professional tap dancer here, she's at least a good amateur. So let's go ahead and see what you got.
Okay, and I do want to promise to Craig and Jacob, once again, I'm on the record, I am not going to fall.
And if you do, I'm not cutting it.
If I do, I give you full permission. So, all right.
After watching you.
Well,
that was into that mat.
I know. I told you I needed to be on the mat.
Oh, that was pretty awesome. All right, Craig, you're feeling it now, aren't you?
I'm amazed. That was the best display of talent on this podcast.
Yeah.
Well, I'm glad that I could prove you guys wrong.
Yeah, all right.
Not gonna fall.
All right, well, I don't know what we're going to do next week for an encore, but it won't be as exciting, I'm sure, but you'll still want to tune in.
Try it next week, right?
Yeah, I'm going to try it next week.
I won't be here to see that next week.
Oh, I know. You're going to be celebrating your birthday. So happy early birthday, by the way.
Well, thank you. Thank you. I'll be in Boston.
On the podcast next week, it's Kyle
Paul. Should have just made a thud noise at the end.
Until then, I'm Kyle Mullen. Take care.